Nicely done this morning. Wasn't that great worship with these guys? Let's give them a hand. Thank you. I always love the tight rhythm section by Gordy. And Brad had a little solo. That was sweet. I love that this morning. Well, as I was thinking about just kind of our time together this morning, it brought me back a little bit to college, which is like 500 years ago, it seems, or feels. I know you guys are kind of just out and making your way in life, but for those of us, it was a very long time ago. One of the things that I had a chance to do was go on a summer missions project. I was involved in a ministry called Campus Crusade for Christ, and that's who I work with now. But the summer was an opportunity to go all the way back to this foreign land called South Carolina and be on this mission project and to be with a bunch of other college students who've come from all across the United States to do the same thing, to get jobs in the community and to trust God to have an impact on the beaches and share our faith and lead Bible studies and do all kinds of things. So it was my first cross-cultural experience because I met people from the South. And that was a very interesting experience to meet people from the South. They talk so slowly and they talk so deliberately and they had an attraction about them that just made certain men just go crazy. Especially the lady folk with just the nice syrupy way they kind of talked. And so we had to get jobs in the community and it was kind of the known thing that, look, you're just here to get to do ministry. Just get any kind of job you want. So a bunch of us got a job at McDonald's. And it's probably hard for you to kind of look back and believe this about me, but I was a little bit of a crazy guy in college. And as I was working in this McDonald's, it just became a great place to have fun with the guys that I worked with. We had seven people from our missions project that were working there. So we just had a lot of fun going in and working and trying to work hard and also be a witness to our manager and the other employees and stuff. But there are times it got away from me a little bit, like when we'd have pickle races on the grill. You know, you throw a couple of pickles out and pour some hot water and they'd flop around and you'd see whose pickle touched the back of the grill first. You know, that happened once in a while. Every once in a while at the breakfast time, I would interview my manager with a dripping egg beater asking about today's activities. And he'd say, "Ben, get back to work." Just, you know. One time I actually gave him a plate of uncooked Big Macs just to see what he would do. So they were frozen beef patties and untoasted buns. And he was like, "Ben, there's something wrong with this picture here." You know. Another occasion, he would stand in front of this big thing that had the slide for all the food to go down, and he'd have to kind of figure out how much food to order based on the crowd. It was really kind of an interesting little game, so we called it the bin game, and I'd often interview him about the bin game and how it's going to work today, and he'd say, "Ben, get back to work," you know. One time I was goofing around a little too much. This one boss of ours, who was just really stern and really gruff and really kind of mean, she said, "Ben, what are you doing right now? Where are you going?" I said, "Edith, I'm coming over here to give you a big fat hug." And she was like, she didn't know what to do. So I worked hard, but I was a little bit of a goofball. And the way this project worked was that they were Campus Crusade full-time staff, adults, who were there to run the thing. And then about halfway through, they would kind of turn over the responsibilities to everybody. And it was coming to be about that time where they're going to start assigning jobs to people about who gets to do what. And so the gentleman that was running our whole project, this staff guy who lived in New England, he called me. He said, "Hey, can I talk to you after work someday?" And I had done some kind of crazy skit earlier that week, you know, and I just thought, you know, it's going to be one of those talks again. It's one of those. I was the kind of guy that pretty much every year one of my teachers would pull me aside and just say, "You know, you got a lot of spirit. You got a lot of spunk. You're just a funny guy, but you gotta settle down, you know." And I thought, dang it, you know, this is what's gonna happen. Is this guy's gonna? I did something wrong. Somebody told on me at work, or a skit was inappropriate. I don't know what it was. And so I'm at this guy's apartment, and I'm wearing my green uniform from McDonald's, smelling like fries, going, "Just drop the boom on me, please." And he's kind of having this small talk, and how's the project going, and how's your Bible study? I'm like, "Oh, come on, dude, just cut to the chase. Just tell me what I did wrong." And so there's this pause, and he says, "Ben, I want to ask you to lead the project." I'm like, "You've got to be kidding me. You want me to lead this project? You're going to turn this whole thing over to me and a team. You want me to lead this team?" I thought he was nuts. I thought, "You're absolutely crazy." But he said, "You're going to be fine because we're going to have a team with you." And he said, "I'll be praying for you. And I'm going to be checking in with you." And the thing that was crazy to me was to go from being a follower to being a leader is quite a big step. It's a big responsibility. And it was a scary responsibility for me as someone who just finished his sophomore year. But to know that this guy, who I really respected, who walked with Christ for some time and was a leader within Campus Crusade, said, you know what, I'm going to be praying for you. That meant a lot to me. And I think it meant a lot to the disciples when they really understood just Jesus' heart about what he was praying for them. And that's what I want us to take a look at. I want us to finish or continue on in our kind of look and discussion about Jesus' high priestly prayer in John 17. And I'm going to be reading out of the New International Version. I really like this version as it comes to just the part that I was studying today. But I'm going to be reading from verses 6 through 19. So follow along as I read in your Bibles. Jesus is praying and he says to the Father, I have revealed you to those whom you gave me out of the world. They were yours, you gave them to me, and they have obeyed your word. Now they know that everything you have given me comes from you. For I gave them the words you gave me, and they accepted them. They knew a certainty that I came from you, and they believed that you sent me. I pray for them. I am not praying for the world, but for those you have given me, for they are yours. All I have is yours. And all you have is mine. And glory has come to me through them. I will remain in the world no longer, but they are still in the world, and I am coming to you. Holy Father, protect them by the power of your name, the name you gave me, so that they may be one as we are one. While I was with them, I protected them and kept them safe by that name you gave me. None has been lost except the one doomed to destruction, so that the scriptures would be fulfilled. I am coming to you now, but I say these things while I am still in the world, so that they may have the full measure of my joy within them. I have given them your word, and the world has hated them, for they are not of the world any more than I am of the world. My prayer is not that you take them out of the world, but that you protect them from the evil one. They are not of the world, even as I am not of it. Sanctify them by the truth. Your word is truth. As you sent me into the world, I have sent them into the world. For them I sanctify myself, that they too may be truly sanctified. What's really interesting about this passage of Scripture is, and I kind of had to keep reminding myself as I'm trying to just understand what's being prayed here, is the idea is that this is a prayer. Jesus is praying. This isn't simply a teaching time where he's trying to make a point. He's engaged in a spiritual conversation with his Father. And as I'm reading through this and listening to this, the thing that keeps hitting me is that I think there's a lot of emotion around what's being prayed. That it's not just that we're trying to understand what is being prayed, but to understand the real emotion that's involved with this. I'm not trying to suggest that Jesus was overly emotional. I'm saying the idea that the stuff he's praying about has a lot of emotion packed into it. And so what I want us to do is I want us to kind of look through two things, basically. I want us to look at, first of all, what is it that he prayed? And then secondly, why? What were the motivations? What was going on in his mind and heart, as we can tell, possibly by these words, to get behind the reasons for his praying? So the big idea that I want us to start off with is, first of all, is what is it that he prayed for his disciples? The what? The real essence of it is found, there's three times that he says, protect them. That's the big idea. He's saying to the Father, I want you to protect them. He says it once in verse 11, once in verse 12, talking about his own protection, and then again in verse 15. But the essence of what he's coming to the Father about is saying, Father, I want you to protect them. And the idea behind this word is simply to watch over, to guard, but it suggests a sense of watchful care. There's something that's going to be happening to these guys that he's very concerned about, that he's bringing this to the Father. Now think about where we are. Where we are in the life and story of Christ. We've just finished the Last Supper. This is the ending of the discourse in the upper room. From here, they go to the Garden of Gethsemane, where Christ wrestles with his Father about going through with this mission of going to the cross. He has his disciples fall asleep with him and can't even be involved with helping him and praying that. Then you have this crazy group of soldiers that come in and take him away. And then he has all these series of trials. Then he's whipped and beaten. Then he's thrown on a cross. Within 24 hours or less than 24 hours of him praying this prayer, he's going to be dead. Massive turmoil is going to happen in the lives and the hearts of these men that he's praying for. This is the context of where we're at. And he says, Father, protect these guys. Watch out for these guys. Be careful to take care of them. There's actually a few things that he's talking about in the idea of protecting. First of all, is to protect them from the evil one, verse 15. It's really interesting that when we think about how Jesus consistently helped us understand that there really is an enemy that is after all of us as Christians. He said in John 10:10 that the thief comes to steal, kill, and destroy. See, that's what Satan wants to do. He doesn't want to just be an annoyance to Christians. He doesn't want to just kind of give you a bad day. He wants to destroy you. He wants to kill me. He wants to really snuff you and me out as followers. Matter of fact, he said to Peter, this is such a crazy way that he said this, and the reality of what he said, as Peter was, he was telling Peter about how you're going to deny me, he said, Peter, Satan has demanded to sift you like wheat. Just think about that for a second. He wants to sift you like wheat. He wants to just take you apart. He wants to see what you're made of. He wants to see how you're going to respond when you get everything thrown at you. This isn't the idea that, oh, I'm going to tempt him with some curly fries, you know. Let's see what Peter does around a bowl of cookies, you know. He's not trying to say something like that, that this is what Jesus is trying to do. He's just trying to throw you off your game a little bit, buddy. He's just trying to annoy you a little bit. He wants to wipe you out. It's really interesting because the idea is that we have this very, very real enemy. You see, Jesus knows this enemy. He knows this enemy. When you back this whole picture out and start from the beginning of the Bible in the book of Genesis, there's a small promise that's made that says, I'm going to provide someone who's going to take care of this sin problem. And what's going to happen is he's going to have an enemy who's going to bruise him on the heel, but this person's going to crush him on his head. And now we're fast forwarding to where this battle is really taking place. For hundreds and hundreds of years, this idea of this spiritual battle between the devil and God is taking place in the next 15 to 18 hours. He's just already been tempted by the devil face to face, remember, after his baptism. Jesus knows what this enemy is about. He knows what this enemy can do. And he's saying, God, protect them. Protect them from this enemy. There's a friend of mine who's writing a book right now on spiritual warfare in marriage, and he's asked me to read it and make a comment. I've never done that before. It's like, I don't know how my little quote's going to appear in his book, so I've got to make sure it's a nice-looking quote or pithy or something. So I've got the pre-release of his book, and what's interesting, he's talking about just spiritual warfare in marriage. And one of the things that he's found in his research is that when you look at just the way the devil has been depicted in history, especially in art, in the medieval times, the devil was depicted as a beast. I mean, he was this ugly, gnarly, nasty beast when you see him in these paintings. But how he's portrayed today in movies, in some art, and even in some literature, is he's kind of portrayed as a slick guy in a suit. You know? It's true that he's an angel of light. But the idea behind this suit is just this really innocuous kind of smart, savvy guy. And Jesus knows that what's behind that suit is a raging beast that wants to devour these men. And it's interesting when you think about how he's doing that right now, how he wants to do that in the church, how he wants to just, you think about the culture we live in, the challenges that Christians have faced throughout the centuries, you can see he's really at work, isn't he? And he's really at work today. He's trying to blow stuff up. There's a pretty famous church that's just had a big, big thing that's blown up back in Chicago, a guy named Bill Hybels and Willow Creek Community Church. And there's a church that's been faithful to God and done amazing things, has over 25,000 members in their church. This church is a part of an association that developed because of their strategy and ministry that has over 11,000 churches connected to it. And now this church is embroiled in this really, really ugly deal and accusations about inappropriate behavior. Because Satan's whole goal is to destroy us, to discredit us, to say this isn't worth following. And see, Jesus knows this is what's happening. I remember the first time I saw this movie called Terminator 2, Judgment Day. Has anyone ever seen that classic? That old black and white classic? Oh, yeah. Starring an Academy Award winner, Arnold Schwarzenegger, you know. I'll be back, you know. He's like the first prototype Terminator, you know. It's just plutonium skeleton with an endoskeleton, plutonium bulldozer, whatever he calls himself, you know. It's just, he just likes a dog like that, you know. And I remember in the second Terminator, because I saw the first one, I was like, oh, wow, this is kind of trippy. The whole concept's kind of trippy, fighting machines and stuff. In the second one, you got this newer class of Terminator. And if you don't know the movie, it's okay. But the Arnold Schwarzenegger guy is kind of like the 55 Chevy. You know, he's kind of cool. You know, it's really hip, and it was great for his time. But this new one is like this like Tesla, just this wow, out of the future Tesla thing. And the deal is that anytime you would hit or try to beat up or shoot or dismember or whatever you do to this new Terminator, it was liquid metal, and it would just kind of gather back together over time, and it'd come back and reconstitute and keep on going. And I remember the first time I saw that, I thought, that is wicked. There's no way you can stop this thing unless you drop it into a vat of, you know, molten metal, which, you know, that's what exactly happened. Yeah, yeah, sorry about that. That was a spoiler. Yeah, sorry about that. For those of you who are going to go home and rent it tonight, sorry. Yeah, sorry, Chris. But the thing that just hit me when I watched this is how this Terminator was relentless, and just no matter what the other Terminator did to it, it just never, ever quit. And that's exactly what the devil is. And Jesus knows this. He knows this is what his men are facing. And he says, Father, protect them. Because he will be relentless. He's not going to give up. Period. Period. He's not going to say, I'm going to be tough on them in the beginning. You know, they'll ease off a little bit in their 30s or 40s. He's like, no, I'm going to press them until the end. Well, Satan wants to use the usual strategies, especially at this vulnerable time of the disciples' life and the vulnerable time of the church. He wants to use the world and the flesh. Jesus says the idea that the world hates them in verse 14. In other words, the world is hostile to this message. And Satan's going to use this hostile world to really run these guys down, to just break it up from the beginning. Because Jesus knows what this crowd is like, doesn't he? Hasn't he been ministering to this crowd? Hasn't he found resistance from this crowd? He knows exactly what this crowd is going to do to his disciples. He knows them. The message that they were given is a message that the crowd does not want to hear, and that is that Jesus was sent from God as the anointed Messiah. Remember how he kept saying, I'm sent from God. This is who I am. They kept asking him, where are you from? Where are you from? I'm sent from the Father. They didn't like that. They didn't want to hear that. They didn't want to hear that you're the Messiah because they had a preconceived notion of what this is going to look like. And they don't like this message at all. And Jesus knows that's what's going to happen. Because the crowd with Jesus rejected him as Messiah. They believed he was actually from Satan. They crucified him for blasphemy. And they've had a millennium of interpretation and religious practice that now is lying in the balance because of what this teacher said. And they want nothing to do with that guy or his message or his people. And Jesus knew this was coming. And it's interesting, as you go into the book of Acts, how is it that the authorities handled Peter and John when they were preaching? Did they like them? They threw them in jail, didn't they? What did they do to Stephen? They stoned him. What did they do to James? Killed him. Got him with a sword. They didn't like what he had to say. You keep going further into Acts, and you see Paul becomes a Christian. He starts doing all this teaching and preaching. He goes to cities like Derbe and Iconium and Lystra. And what happens to him in all those towns? He gets beaten up because of his message. He even rehearses all the ways that he suffered for the cross because the people he was talking to didn't like his message. They hated him for that message. How is it that all the apostles died? Did they all die a nice, peaceful life in retirement at Apostles Village, you know, kind of deal? Enjoying the kind of the leisurely life of, yeah, I've been an apostle for 55 years, and I'm in the writing season of my life, you know. Going to write a couple of gospels and retire. And No. Every single one of them was martyred. John was boiled in oil. And what about the people that were coming after him with Nero? You see, Jesus knows that this world is going to be really, really hostile to his followers. And he says, Father, protect them. Take care of them. Because people are not going to like their message. I don't know if you've seen some of these throwback newsreels from the 60s. For some reason, I've watched a few in the last few months and been related to different issues. But it's so interesting to me when I look at these civil rights marchers and some of the demonstrations that took place, particularly in the South. And the thing that just tears my heart out is you have these peaceful African Americans who are simply trying to say, hey, look, we just want to sit at the lunch counter like you guys. We just want to ride on a bus like you guys. It's all we want. They just want the same rights in this country that we have, that whites have. We fought in your wars. We fought in the wars. We've given blood. Why can't we vote? Why can't we have these things? That's all they wanted. And there are people, when you watch some of these demonstrations in these newsreels, the way they attacked these civil rights marchers. And the thing that particular to note is not just simply that they attacked, but the looks on their faces. The hatred that they had for African Americans. To say, look, we've got a history of how this works, and this is the way it works, and we don't want to mess with this. We don't want to change this. We don't want to have to change to this new message. And the hatred that they had around that is powerful. And Jesus knows that these guys, in a matter of hours, are going to be faced with this same kind of hatred. And he says, I want to pray for you, that God would take care of you and protect you. Well, the devil's going to use the world, but he's also going to use the flesh. Jesus knows the frailty of the human heart. He knows what's going to happen in the next several hours. These men are about to have a major existential crisis and a serious blow to their faith. All the stuff they've been learning and hanging out with and talking to Jesus, and he's real and he's powerful, gone. Now just think about when you've lost someone that you love very dearly. It's just weird that they're gone. They're all of a sudden gone. You can't talk to them. You can't see them. There's just the grief and the shock and the weirdness about losing somebody. And that's what's going to happen to these guys really soon. And as he's praying, he knows what they don't know. And the grief about that and the shock is going to challenge them in their flesh. You see, the biggest challenge that Satan's going to lay on them and tempt them is doubt. You remember all through the book of John, as we've been reading, what's Jesus calling people to do? He's saying, believe, 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 believe. And it's interesting, you see, in the earlier part of this prayer, he says, Father, the words I've given them, they have believed. They have accepted. They are growing. They got it. It's like, you know, when you're trying to teach your kid how to ride a bike, you know, like, I don't know if they got it. You let them go, they got it. Yeah, they got it. And now it's just this really small faith that they're holding on to, and it's going to be snuffed by this doubt, this death. It's a real vulnerable place that these guys are in with this faith that they're holding on to. This high priestly prayer notes that they truly believe in with certainty, but they're going to be pushed. They're going to be challenged. Just think about this. He's going to tempt them with unbelief because the human heart feels pain really deeply, don't we? Really deeply. And Satan knows that. And he wants to twist that pain. Look at the deep sadness they're going to face. Peter's denial. I mean, when you look at his denial and just the way it hit him, like, oh my gosh, I can't believe I actually did that. How do you think the other guys in the group felt when they heard about Peter's denial? That just rattled them. The confidence they had in a guy like Peter, like, hey, I'm in it with this guy. Now this guy doesn't believe? That deep sadness that came over them, fear. Jesus was just taken away from them in their presence by an army. And they scatter. Like, what's going to happen to us? Are they coming after me? I've never hidden from the law. I don't know what that's like. But these guys are now starting to feel this tremendous fear of what's going to happen to us now that they've taken Jesus. The confusion they must have felt. The guy they've been following and believing in is the Messiah who's going to bring in his kingdom is dead. He's gone. He's dead. It's like, wait a minute. What are we going to do now? The confusion must have been thick. The despair they must have felt. Because not only is he dead, now he's wrapped and he's put in a tomb. I mean, just think about that. This was the vision. This is the layout. This is what we're going to do. I'm the Messiah. I'm the kingdom. Boom, gone, dead, buried. And these guys are struggling to believe, is this thing even real anymore? Who was I listening to? And Satan wants to fill their hearts with doubt, because when our hearts get filled with doubt, they just get pulled down and we stop believing. Dear friend of mine, I've been hanging out with him for a little while because his marriage has been on the rocks for a while, and his marriage is now over. And he's somebody that's been in full-time ministry. And matter of fact, we worked with the same outfit. And when they were ministering overseas, they started to see some leaks in their marriage. There are things about her past that were coming out in the sense of just the challenges that she faced growing up in an abusive home. Their first child, they got pregnant. She lost the baby. And just the pain and the anguish from that was something she had a really hard time recovering from. How could God allow that to happen? How could God allow me to be raised in this kind of home? How could God allow me to lose my child? How could God allow me to lose heart for this mission? And as those doubts just kept growing and growing, they went into her marriage. I don't think I'm supposed to be in this marriage. I don't even know if I'm supposed to be in this faith. And it just pulled her all the way down. Because that's what doubt does. And that's what Satan wants to do. And Jesus is saying, protect them. Because they're going to run into all kinds of doubt. They're going to run into all kinds of stuff because of their hearts. The second part of this flesh thing that Satan's going to use to attack them is he's going to tempt them with their pride. He's going to tempt these new young leaders with their pride. The human heart, he knows, is radically self-centered. Radically self-centered. And Jesus is praying for them to be protected from that. You just kind of follow along in the New Testament. In the book of Acts, we meet this couple, Ananias and Sapphira. And what do? They're all supposed to be kind of, hey, we're all pitching in. We're all throwing in some money to help each other. And they're like, we're going to hold a little back. They're lying to the Holy Spirit. They're going to do their own thing. They're going to go their own way. You start to see that selfishness pop up. The arguments about how the Greeks are supposed to be served. Well, we're not being served right. Well, who's going to serve them? Well, how's he going to take care of that? You know? Something about church and food service just drives everyone nuts, doesn't it? It's just like, I thought you were bringing the donuts. I thought you were bringing the donuts. You brought those donuts? Why are those? Those donuts are evil, you know? We only get donuts and blah, blah, blah. So now they're having this issue that it involves all these ethnicities, the Greeks, the Jews, the Romans. How do you get these different ethnicities to blend together? Paul confronts Peter about the way he's showing favoritism to the Jewish folks. So now you got some leadership issues that's going on. Barnabas and Paul have a disagreement about a guy named John Mark. So now they kind of have their own little split. Paul warns Timothy. He says, listen, when you're going to look for elders, make sure that the elders that you're choosing are not self-willed. In other words, there's something about us as human beings when it comes to leadership that gets really weird and gets really crazy. And some of you in this room know exactly what I'm talking about. And he knows the human heart, with this brand new thing called the church, has a real possibility to become somebody else's church, not Jesus's. You know, one of the things that happens from time to time, being on the speaker team with Family Life, my wife Janet and I get to do some speaking. There's about 40, 50 couples and some pastors and authors and all kinds of things. And unfortunately, sometimes people crash and burn. And they do the wrong things, and they leave, as they should, to just kind of really get attention to what's going on in their life and what they need help in. And I remember this one guy, I heard word that this one guy was leaving the team. And it was one of these, gosh, you know, I'm starting to fill in the blanks. You know, gee, was he inappropriate with another person? Was he inappropriate with money? Was he, you know, is it not an affair but a sexual thing? What, you know, what was this thing? And what came back, and as I understood and talked to the people close to them, the reason that the elders asked him to leave and fired him was narcissism. That this was too much about him. It was too much about his things, his way, his methods, his ideas. It's like, I'm the guy in charge. Everyone falls beneath. And the elder said, that's killing us. And rightly so. And yet Jesus understood that this is one of the ways that Satan's going to come in and tempt him. The world and the flesh. And he's going to try to destroy them. See, Jesus knows all of this is coming. And he's praying for them not to quit. He said, Father, protect them. There's so much that's going to come down on them. Protect them. Help them not to quit. He's not just praying for them about the attacks. He's also praying that they would be protected for something. Not just from something, but be protected for something. And namely, what that is unity. That's the big idea. Protect them so that they can be unified. Keep them from all these things that are going to destroy them for the purpose that they can be unified. And demonstrate to others what this looks like. See, he doesn't just want them to survive. He wants them to thrive as a church, to reflect to the world what God himself is like. Verse 11 says, so that they may be one as we are one. It's about showing a united community, not a divided one through that self-centered leadership. Now, I think the next week's passage is going to delve in even more to how this really fleshes out for us as a community to demonstrate this. But I want to point out a couple things. First of all, the idea is that the unity that he's talking about is really the essence of the Trinity. It's the essence of the Trinity. Verse 10, he says, all I have is yours, and all you have is mine. Jesus is reflecting the idea that we are one. The Father and the Son are one. In John 5:19, he says, truly I tell you, the Son can do nothing by himself. He can only do what he sees his Father doing, because whatever the Father does, the Son also does. That's what the Trinity is. Jesus said in John 10:30, he said, I and the Father are one. And the picture that he's trying to help them understand is, God protect them so they'll be one like you and me and the Spirit. That there's three diverse beings that are in absolute complete unity. The diversity and the unity is what Jesus is praying that they will be able to express to each other. That we can, yeah, be different cultures and different backgrounds and different languages and different everything. But you know what? We're one when it comes to Christ. That's what he's asking them to be protected for. Because unity of the church is important to God because it demonstrates that. It demonstrates that we belong to him. When we're unified, we reflect what God is like. And Jesus is praying that that's what they'll demonstrate to others. Paul said in Ephesians 4:3, he said, be diligent to preserve the unity of the Spirit in the bond of peace. And John got even more practical about unity. He didn't just kind of throw it out there as, hey, make sure you're unified, you sing the same songs, and, you know, park on the same side of the streets, or, you know, use the right kind of paint or whatever. It wasn't just this fluffy kind of thing. John got down into the dirt, into the nitty-gritty of what unity looks like. In 1 John 3:16-18, he says, this is how we know what love is. Jesus Christ laid down his life for us, and we ought to lay down our lives for our brothers and sisters. If anyone has material possessions and sees a brother or sister in need, but has no pity on them, how can the love of God be in that person? Dear children, let us not love with words or speech, but with actions and truth. He's saying, I'm praying that these will be people who demonstrate what unity looks like. They don't just talk about it. They live it. The kind of picture that we see in Acts chapter 4, verse 32, talking about the early church, that says, all the believers were one in heart and mind. No one claimed that any of their possessions was their own, but they shared everything they had. So Jesus is praying, protect them for this reason, that they'll show the world what that's like, that kind of unity. I think I might have shared this story before. I'll get to the point quickly if I have. I seem to think I have. But there's a gentleman that used to be involved in government in the state of Montana, and his name was Mike Mansfield. And Mike was a representative of U.S. Congress for the state of Montana for served five terms as a representative. Then he went on to serve in the Senate for 4 terms. So he spent, 35 years representing Montana and helping. He served under 7 different presidents. He was voted as the leader, the majority leader of the Senate. The longest running person who's ever held that position was Mike Mansfield. So his peers said, yeah, we want to keep you as the leader. The leader of 100 pretty self-centered guys, especially at that time in the 60s, right? He was voted the leader of that. He became an ambassador to Japan under Jimmy Carter. President Ronald Reagan asked him to continue, so then he became the longest running or serving person as our ambassador to Japan. And when he was asked by the state of Montana, they said, hey, Mike, you've been a great, great servant for the state of Montana. We want to build a statue in your honor. He said, the only way you're going to build a statue of me is if it's me and my wife, Maureen. Because she has been the backbone and the teammate that I've had from the very beginning. They were married for 66 years. Can you think of any guy? How many statues have you seen of a really smart, successful guy with his wife? Has anyone ever been to the Hall of Statues in Washington, D.C.? It's like 100 men. That's what it is. They're getting more women in there, but it's like 100 guys in really cool outfits, you know? But this guy says, look, if you're going to build a statue, it's of me and my wife, because we're a team. We're united. And Jesus is praying, God, protect them so that's what they look like. They lead on the same team. They love the same way. They're a united group of people. So Jesus knows the beauty of this unity, and he's praying that his men will experience it and they'll model it. So he's asking that they're protected from the evil one. He's asking that they're protected for unity. He's asking, thirdly, that he's protected how? A certain way. Protect them by your name. There's a couple of words that he uses in here to say, when you're going to protect them, how are you going to do that? Well, first of all, he uses the word name. Protect them by your name. He mentions that 3 times in verse 11 and in 12, talks about this idea. And the simple idea is that Jesus has been talking to these guys about the Father for a long time. In the Gospel of John, 96 times he refers to the Father. That's what we have recorded. We don't know how often he talked to them about the Father. And he's saying, Father, I want you to help them, protect them in your name, the name that they're coming to understand as God, that they relate to, that they have a relationship to, that they belong to. Help them understand that they belong to you. They don't just know me, they belong to you. I've been telling them about you. You gave me these words to tell them. They've accepted these words. They've believed these words. They've come to believe that I am from you. So protect them in your name, in the power of that name. What's interesting about that, when you think of the prayer that Jesus taught us to pray, how does it start? Our Father. It's interesting that it doesn't start with the Father or Holy Father or some other address. They could say, hey, I'm just an individual. I've got this prayer to God. It's just called, I started the Father or Father in Heaven. Or it starts with our Father. In other words, if you're a Christian, you and I have that in common. It is the Father that we hold in common because of our relationship with the Son. And so he's saying, hold them in the power of this name that they belong to you. It's so amazing. The next word that he talks about is the idea of truth. To protect them in the truth. Sanctify them by the truth. Your word is truth. This idea of sanctify is to consecrate, to set aside, to set apart. That use this truth, your words, to really help them know that they are set apart, that they belong to you. The words that Jesus was given is to communicate, is that communicate to these men who you are. You are the one sent from me. You are the Messiah. You're my anointed Messiah. And as they have come to understand this and hold on to this and believe this truth, these words, he's saying, let that be the thing that holds them, the power of their relationship to me. And because of their relationship to the Son, their relationship to the Father. So interesting, when Jesus was baptized, Luke 3:22, you hear the Father say in a loud, audible voice that people heard, the Father says, you are my Son, whom I love, and with you I am well pleased. And see, the idea is that if we belong to the Son, God loves us the same way that he loves the Son. He's saying, Father, help them understand that if they belong to me, they belong to you. And protect them in your name. They've got to have that orientation that when they come tumbling out of the surf, they know where true north is. That they belong to you because of what I've done in our relationship. On July 16th, 1999, there was yet another tragedy that befell the Kennedy family. Just amazing when you look at their life and all the things that had happened to their family, starting with their oldest Joe dying in World War II, then to John, and then to Bobby. John's son on that night was just going to be going to a wedding. His wife, Carolyn, and his cousin were going to his sister-in-law, we're going to his cousin's wedding in Martha's Vineyard somewhere. And he got on his plane. He was a pilot. And what happened was, it was pretty hazy that night when he was out flying. And even though by law he was not required to be able to use his instruments only, it was one of those nights that it would have been good to be trained in that. And John wasn't trained in that. And what happened is, they said the cause of the accident and the death was spatial disorientation. In other words, he didn't know where he was. Because it's so hazy, he lost sight of where the horizon was. And when he lost sight of the horizon, that's when he crashed. And Jesus is saying there's a horizon that believers got to hold on to, that you belong to the Father because of the Son. You belong to the Father no matter what is thrown at you, no matter what you encounter, whether it's doubt or the way you're treated, you belong to the Father. Don't forget that, Christian. Father, help them to know that they belong to you. Well, those are some of the things that he prayed for them. I just want to close our time a little bit as thinking, but why? Why did he pray these things? You know, as I'm looking through this, I'm just trying to look at it like, okay, almost didactically teaching what's being said. And again, this is the middle of a prayer. We're entering into this prayer. A prayer is an intimate conversation with God. And why is he praying this way? It's not just understanding what he prayed. It's not like he's just concerned about the tactical strategy of establishing the church, you know. He knew that his church was going to survive. He knew the gates of hell are not going to prevail against his church. So it wasn't just a tactical prayer he was giving. This is a personal thing. This was really, really personal to him. And personal for a couple of reasons. First of all, he was mindful of his relationship with the Father. This is who he's talking to. In a sense, he's almost rehearsing with the Father the journey with these guys. He's saying, Father, I've done what you've asked me to do with these men. You gave me these men. I did what you asked me. I gave them your words. And what did they do? These guys believed. They even glorified me. They believed that I came from you. I didn't lose any of them. He says, Father, I am praying for these. These are your guys. You gave them to me. It's a stewardship. You see, the heart of Jesus to say, I want to fulfill what the Father has given me. I want to be obedient and pleasing to my Father. And you see on his heart that his motivation is to say, Father, I did everything you asked me to do. And what's so powerful about this prayer, I think, is that, again, we've heard Jesus talk about his relationship to the Father, that he has a relationship to the Father. He's told the disciples and mentioned this 96 times in the gospel. But what we see right here is we see the relationship. We see this Trinity. We see how he talks to this Father. You know, in these 13 short verses, he refers to the Father 25 times. 25 times. The people you gave me, your words, your men. He has this constant awareness that I have this relationship with the Father. And I'm praying because I want to be pleasing to my Father. I want to do what my Father has asked me to do. Matter of fact, earlier in our passage in verse 4, he says, I want to complete the work that you gave me to do. You see, he's praying because he cares about his obedience to God the Father. And the second reason that he's praying is he's mindful of these men. See, he's leaving them. He's leaving them behind. And he cares really, really deeply about these guys. Three times he says he's going to the Father. It's like, hey, I get to go to this wonderful place. Pretty soon I'm done, and I get to be with you. But these guys are staying behind. I have to leave them here, and I'm going to be somewhere else, and I'm going to be in a much better place, but these guys are staying here. And that's a scary thing when I list all the things we've talked about. He understands that they got to stay here and all that's in front of them, and he really cares about that. In a really silly, small way, I go back to this. I've said it a couple times, but man, when I dropped our first kid off at college, it was the weirdest thing because it's like, I'm leaving you behind. I don't get to see you anymore. I don't get to be around you anymore. I don't know all the details of your life the same way as being in the same house with you. And Jesus is like, I'm leaving these guys behind. And Father, I care about them. I want them to succeed. I want them to do well. He rehearses just even the idea that they've come a long way in their understanding, you know, that they've really come to believe. They've come to believe a certainty. You know, who knows if he was like, hey, Father, remember at the time that Thomas said this, you know? Remember when Peter was such a knucklehead and he did this, you know? It's like Jesus is invested in these men. He's struggled with their ignorance, their stupidity, their whatever. He's invested his time and his energy. It's like, I'm going to not so much miss these guys, but I'm leaving them. I've built this deep relationship with these guys. I love how he even says, I don't care about the rest of the world right now. I want to pray for these guys. You know, does Jesus care about all the children of the world? Yeah, that's what the song says. But right now he's saying, I don't care about the world. I care about these guys. I want to see these guys do well and survive and thrive. I've protected them. I've kept them safe. He's just really put so much energy into this relationship. And the idea is that he really, really loves these men. He really, really loves these men. And he wants to see them protected and do well. He didn't pray just because he's supposed to, and oh yeah, let's pray to demonstrate that we have a relationship and it's time to say my prayers. You know, ways that I can kind of sometimes get caught into my prayer life where it's just a function, a perfunctory kind of thing, you know. It's like, no, I care about the Father and I care about these guys. Well, how does this relate to us? How does this prayer in his heart relate to us? Let me just ask you a couple of questions. First of all, how is the evil one tempting you to disbelieve? See, he wants to destroy us. And the way he's going to destroy us is doubt. And he's going to start that little doubt somehow. Maybe something you didn't get. Maybe something you've been praying for. Maybe there's a part of the Christian faith that's a little bit embarrassing to talk about for you. Maybe you've been hurt some way. I don't know what it is. But he wants to destroy you and me. It's interesting the last couple of days how much I've had some struggle with some discouragement. And I kind of have kind of pulled aside. I thought, well, what about this? What about this? What about this? And, you know, maybe it's this and that. I haven't been sleeping well. Like, no, you know what? I think there's probably some spiritual battle going on in my life. I think it's possible that my discouragement or at times my sadness or my confusion is not just something that happens. There's somebody who wants me to get to stop believing. What's going on in your world now? How is he tempting you to not believe? To do your own thing? To live your own life? And just talk to him once in a while. How is he tempting you? Second of all, are you practicing unity? How's the unity in your marriage, if you're married? How's the unity with your kids? How's that going? If you're not married, how's the community? How's your church? How's the unity in your church? Is there anyone in this room that you need to get right with? Anything that's been said or hasn't said that needs to be taken care of in this room? Is there anybody outside of this room that you need to talk to? God takes our unity very, very seriously. And if we're saying one thing but doing another thing, we're not being obedient. We're not walking with him. We're not demonstrating what it looks like to have a relationship with the Father and be unified. So how is your unity? And lastly, this is really interesting to me, and I'll say it, and I'm a little weird. I feel a little weird saying it. But how can Jesus pray for you? You know, it's interesting that Jesus said a few times that he's praying for us. How he said to Peter, he said, Peter, Satan's demanded to sift you like wheat, but I have prayed for you. In this passage, the thing that hit me as I was studying this is the simple, short statement. He says, I pray for them. And you see this simple yet pure yet powerful desire on the part of Jesus to say to the Father, I care about these guys. I pray for them. Romans 7:34 says he's intercessing for us, or excuse me, 8:25 says he's intercessing for us right now. Hebrews 7 says he's intercessing for us right now. He's interceding for us. What do you want him to pray for you for? So interesting, when I did that, as I was reading through this, I kind of got super choked up. Because I've had other people pray for me. And it's always a nice thing when they go, hey, how can I pray for you? I go, oh man, thank you. And I'll share that with them and they'll pray for me. But to think that Jesus is poking into my life saying, how can I pray for you? That blows me away. He's not just serving some role as intercessor up there, whatever that means. He's actually praying for you and for me. What do you want him to pray for? What do you need? Now, you have complete access to the Father. This is why I don't fully know how to say this. But it's just the idea that Jesus really, really cares about you. He really, really cares about me. And that's why he prays us. Well, he's praying that these men would be protected from devil, the world, the flesh, that they'd be protected for unity, they'd be protected by the power of his name. Why? Because he loves them so, so, so much. One movie that I've really enjoyed that, this might be a spoiler alert too, so excuse me, but it's a movie called We Were Soldiers. It stars Mel Gibson. It's a story about the first battle in Vietnam that American soldiers were involved with. And Colonel Hal Moore was the man who was to train and take these men via helicopters, the first time they were going to use the Huey aircraft to get into a landing zone and fight all this kind of stuff. And so he was a soldier, and he realized that this is a very historic place that they were having this first battle, a place where others from other countries didn't really do very well against Vietnam. And he knew that this was a really tough battle that he was facing. And what he told his men, he said, gentlemen, I'm going to be with you. I'm going to be the first one on the battlefield, and I'm going to be the first one off. Last one off, excuse me. Thank you. That'd be a little different, wouldn't it? Because I'm a chicken, and I want you to know I'm a yellow-bellied chicken. Thank you, Richard. So much for the emotional impact of that story, right? So, yes, I'm going to be the first one on the battlefield and the last one off. And Jesus says, I know exactly where you guys are going. And I've led you there, and I'm going to take you all the way through, all the way home. Let me pray for us. Father, thank you so much that we can come to you and address you as Father. That holy name that we can all in this room call out because what your Son Jesus has done for us. He's the reason we call you Father. And we know you like Jesus knows you. Thank you so much. And Jesus, I thank you that you didn't just go to heaven to relax and kick back, but you're in heaven now wanting to intercede for us and to pray for us. And Jesus, I ask that you would help all of us to walk with you, to do business with you, that you'd guard our hearts from the doubt, the fears, the disobedience that we might be facing. Will you help us, please? And Spirit, I thank you that you have come to live in our lives, to remind us of what Jesus taught, to give us the power to live this Christian life. So I'm just so grateful that we get to see the Trinity in action, that we see you in your heart for the Father and for your men. And I know that's exactly how you feel about us as we look at how you prayed for them. In Jesus' name, amen.